54 through 56. It takes us from Acts 24 to Acts 26. If you didn't get a copy of these, if you raise your hand, I'll be happy to bring you one. You get one or two. Anybody else? Turn your Bibles to Acts 23. That's the chapter we're in tonight. And page 129 in your folders. Acts 23 and page 129. All right, Paul is, of course, in Jerusalem. And as we saw in last chapter, chapter 22, he made the speech to the Jewish crowd, and that did not go very well in terms of him accomplishing what it was that he wanted. He had to be rescued again by the Roman commander who's in charge of keeping the peace in Rome. And so, as we concluded chapter 22, the commander decided to bring Paul before the council, or the Sanhedrin. That's in chapter 22 and verse 30. Perhaps he could get some information through that venue in terms of why every time Paul starts to speak in public, there's this commotion, this uproar. And that took us through the end of the 22nd chapter. So when tonight's chapter or tonight's lesson begins, Paul, it says, looks intently at the council. What is the first thing that he says to the Sanhedrin? All right, I have lived in all good conscience before God up unto this day. So verses 1 through 10 has Paul addressing the council of the Sanhedrin. And that's the first thing that he says. Everything that I've done, everywhere that I've gone, everything that I've said, taught, did, whatever, I've not violated my conscience. Is that a true statement? That was a true statement. Now, I'm asking here in the question, think back about what we've seen Paul do, recorded for us in the Acts record. What's been some of the things he's done that would be included in this inclusive statement? All that I've done, I have lived my life with a perfectly good conscience before God up to this day. Right. He was opposed to the gospel. And when we were first introduced to Saul, as you remember back at the end of chapter 7, the stoning of Stephen, then into chapter 8, Paul breathing threats against the church, and then into chapter 9 when he was specifically going after Christians, Jewish Christians up in Damascus, he was trying to haul them off to jail and even consenting to their death as he had been to Stephen's. How could he have lived in good conscience in those situations? He thought that was the right thing to do. Now, of course, he was wrong about that, but in that sense, that was the right thing to do. And given this question, I want to have just a real short discussion on the conscience. And I think this statement of Paul affords us a good opportunity to do that. Conscience is important, isn't it? Everybody's got one. Whether or not you listen to it, it's a different matter, but everyone's got a conscience. Let's look at some of these verses. 1 Corinthians chapter 10. Starting in verse 23. This is a short chapter tonight. It won't take us very long to go through it, so I want to take the time to go through these passages. And the reason I'm going to do this is because the last part of question one here, so many people use their conscience as a guide for their religion. And that needs to be explored just for a minute or two. 1 Corinthians 8, 1 Corinthians 10, and Romans 14 share a few things in common. They're not all dealing with the same exact issue. I don't think we need to confuse that. There is some major differences in those three chapters. But the one thing they do share is that they're talking about matters of conscience, particularly whether or not one should eat meat. Romans 14 doesn't come out and say this, but in 1 Corinthians it does. Specifically, meat that had been sacrificed where? To an idol somewhere. All right. Now, let's just read these 11 verses. Gary, would you read for us, please, 1 Corinthians 10, 23 through 33, and then we'll talk about it some. All right. Thank you, Gary. Now, particularly, Paul is addressing here whose conscience. He says, do things for the sake of conscience. Whose conscience did he say? Yeah, not yours, he said, but the weaker brother who doesn't have your knowledge, who doesn't have your level of understanding. So that would seem, he says, and I think Brother Paul implies, that would certainly take care of a lot of these problems between brethren. One brother could do or know something, and the other brother is somewhat weaker in his understanding or his faith, and he can't do these things. Of course, Paul's talking about doing things that are not inherently sinful, obviously. Just things that would cause some new convert some difficulty, just come out of a pagan religion. And now he sees this meat, he knows where it's come from. So if he eats it, what connection are you going to make in his mind? If I eat this meat? Well, I'm worshiping that idol. And I better not do that. And of course, that would not be the case at all. So conscience is important. In fact, as we says in as the passage that Gary just read, this is for the other man's conscience. Now, what about your own conscience? Look at Romans 14 and verse 13. This would go along with the verses that Gary just read in 1 Corinthians 10. Romans 14 and verse 13 gives us some teaching about conscience as well, if you will. You won't see the word conscience in this text like we just saw in 1 Corinthians 10, but really Paul says, therefore, let us not judge one another anymore, but rather determine this, not to put an obstacle or a stumbling block in a brother's way. This would go along with the teaching in 1 Corinthians 10. That is, for the sake of the other person's conscience, that you not cause them to stumble or to fall. So, conscience is important, yes. Conscience must never be violated. All right? That's thing in Romans 14. At the end of this discussion of these matters that God is indifferent to, whether you're the strong brother or whether you're the weak brother, but what about the one who doubts? Romans 14, Freddie, what's verse 23 say? Well, let's see. Start in the last part of verse 22 and then read through 23 for us, please. So what if you go against your conscience? You've sinned. You've committed sin. Even if it's in areas that would be wrong, but in terms of what you know, maybe we're like Paul. Maybe we just weren't taught enough along the way to know the entire truth about a matter. Let's just say we have limited knowledge. Even in what we know, if we go against our conscience, that's sin as far as we're concerned. So conscience is important. It must never be violated. That's what Paul teaches. And conscience can be improperly trained. Now we get to the issue of Paul. And I listed these passages on the chart on your lesson sheet. Here's all the places in the previous chapters, chapter 7, 8, 9, and 22, where Paul talked about his prior conduct and how he opposed the gospel, how he sought to imprison the Christians, persecute them, even be consenting to their death. Well, if Paul could do that in good conscience, yet that was the wrong thing to do, we're led to conclude, just because your conscience says it's all right, that doesn't, no, it can be trained wrong. You could be wrong in that matter. And then finally, one more point. Conscience can even be seared, can it? 1 Timothy chapter 4, 1 and 2. Talking about in the last times, those will depart from the faith. They'll have their conscience seared as how? As with a hot iron. Somebody can do something so long that eventually they just won't think twice about it. And it's just if they've taken an iron and seared every nerve ending in their arm or some part of their body. And their past feeling. I think the Old King James has the word past feeling, doesn't it? I think that's the phrase. Their past feeling. They don't think about it anymore. Well, that's how the conscience can work in all of us. Well, of course, what we're saying here is that Paul's actions, his statement here, I have lived in good conscience before God up to this day, that tells us that conscience alone cannot be a guide in terms of one's religion. Because Paul was acting religiously in these matters, and he thought he was right before God, didn't he? But what was the truth about it? He was just as wrong as he could be. He wasn't right about it. And so today when we talk to somebody, or maybe we've been in this position before, and we have the idea of this person, that, well, you know, I think I'm right about that. That's just what my conscience is leading me to believe and to do and to practice. Well, does the conscience need to be involved? Sure it does. But we can't make it mean more than that. And Paul is the prime example. And this one statement here in Acts 23 and verse 1 tells us that sufficient by itself it is not to be a guide in terms of how one stands before the Lord. All right. Any comments or questions anybody has? I didn't mean to sermonize so much there, but this is a good passage to remember talking about. Because someone feels like they're right before God, but their actions could be without authority. Paul was certainly wrong about what he was doing. And his statement nonetheless proved that he was not right. Well, okay, after Paul makes that statement, what happens? I've lived in good conscience. And what took place? I preached that somebody smack him in the mouth. Slap him. And they did. And what did Paul think about that? Yeah, he didn't care much for it, did he? He said, God will smite thee. And what did he call? And by the way, what was the high priest's name? There's a lot of Ananias in the Bible, isn't there? This is another one. But God will smite thee, Ananias. And what did he call him? You whited wall, or you whitewashed wall. You've seen in similar phrase in the eight woes that Jesus pronounced in the Gospel of Matthew. He called the Pharisees whited sepulchres, or whitewashed tombs. Why did they whitewash tombs back in those days? Make them look nice. That was one reason. Well, yep, to hide the uncleanness. And it was important that the Jews would know where a sepulcher is, because if they came in contact with the tomb, what happened to them? They were defiled or unclean. So they would whitewash these to know where they were, but also to kind of sort of pretty them up. But they're clean on the outside, but what about the inside? That was the point Jesus was making. You're full of rottenness and dead men's bones. And so Paul says, you whited wall. So really, what's he calling Ananias? A hypocrite. He's calling him a hypocrite. Very idea. What's the hypocrisy? Why is Ananias a whited wall or a whitewashed wall? All right, he was breaking the law. What particularly was Ananias breaking here? What was he violating that made him a hypocrite? Anybody have any thoughts on that? Why was he a hypocrite? He had ordered Paul to be struck on the mouth, or to be struck, strike him on the mouth. Paul says, do you sit to try me according to the law, and in violation of the law, order me to be struck? Why would it have been a violation of the law to strike Paul? Well, he's a Roman citizen, but I don't think the Jews cared much about whether they were Romans or not. He wasn't guilty. That's right. His case hadn't been heard yet. Notice these passages. In Leviticus 19 and verse 15, just a real basic statute in the law, things were to be done justly and fairly. This was an unfair action on the part of the high priest to smite Paul. But particularly look at John chapter 7, real quickly, and verse 51. There's a statement by Nicodemus. And this, of course, was the same Nicodemus who came to Jesus by night and wanted to talk to him. That's recorded earlier in the Gospels. John 7, and starting in verse 45, you remember the Jews sent the officers away to go apprehend Jesus and bring him back, and they came back empty-handed. And they said, they asked him, basically, to summarize here, you know, why didn't you bring him back? And they said, never a man spake like him. We never heard anybody talk or teach like he did. You'll see that there in verse 46. And their question was, verse 47, have you been duped also? Have you been deceived by this deceiver? No one of the rulers or Pharisees has believed in him, has he? But this multitude, which does not know the law, is accursed. Nicodemus said to them, by comment then, John writes, he who came to him before being one of them. Now the principle is in verse 51. Our law does not judge a man unless what? Unless you first hear the matter. And that's the point that Paul's making here. It's a principle. All he had said so far was, I'm living in good conscience. And I said, smack him. Paul says, that's not being fair about it. The law says we've got to hear the matters out before judgment is rendered. It's already clear where Ananias is going to sit on this matter. He's got Paul guilty already before the matter's even been heard. So Paul says, Ananias says what he says, then Paul replies to him. And after Paul says this, who says something next? What's the next statement made? All right, Paul has to sort of be corrected now. Paul is corrected. And he was speaking in a reviling way to the high priest. And again, the Exodus 22 and verse 28 is a statute in the law that says you're to show honor or respect or deference to the high priest. So Paul's statement, calling Ananias a whited wall, certainly wasn't, although it's true, again, things need to be done in the proper way. And so Paul again, in fact, and what was Paul's defense? I didn't know he was the high priest. And I think it's implied Paul would say, if I'd have known, I wouldn't have said what I just said. If had I known, yes, he quotes the statute: "You shall not speak evil of a ruler of your people." End of verse 5. So after this initial exchange, not getting off on a good foot, are they? Paul perceives something. Now we move into the inside of Paul's mind. What does he notice? What does he know? All right, there's a division on this council. And that wouldn't have been anything secret. What party does Paul come from? He's a Pharisee. He would have known what they believe. He also would have known what the Sadducees believe. So this isn't anything, some new great revelation. Paul's just using what is probably common knowledge about the parties that make up the council. So he divided. Go ahead. If it was an uncommon thing for the high priest, why would it have been uncommon for the high priest to be on the council? Well, okay, maybe he would know who individually was the high priest, but to be surprised that the council would contain the high priest, I think, is a different matter. Maybe that's the reason. Charles? Okay, maybe his clothing did not reveal that. All right. Okay, all right. Perhaps he wasn't adorned in the usual customary way. That certainly is entirely plausible and possible. Yes, Doug? Mm-hmm. All right. Yeah. Yep. Paul's certainly not intimidated here with this audience by any stretch of the imagination. That is correct. Okay. So he perceives the council divided, and it's divided along what doctrinal lines. All right. The resurrection is the difference. Who believes what? Pharisees believe in the resurrection and something else, it says. Angels. Sadducees believe neither. They deny both what the Pharisees accept. And so, Paul perceiving this, what's the next thing he says? I'm a Pharisee. The son of a Pharisee. And then I am on trial. for the hope of the resurrection. And that just divides the lines immediately. And Paul knew that. Now, this isn't a gimmick. Is Paul's statement true? Yes, it's a true statement. It's an entirely true statement. But he knew that would get results. And so, being the political parties that they were, absolutely, they start their own deliberations. Describe the discussion amongst the council members. Was it cordial and gentlemanlike? No, hardly. Dissension. In fact, my version, I think, in verse 9 uses the word a great uproar. This was not calm. And there they go at it one at another. And you just can imagine just Paul just standing there watching this going on. And finally someone speaks up, a scribe of the Pharisaic party. What's this scribe say? He's innocent. As far as I'm concerned, I've heard enough. He's done nothing wrong. Because I agree with him. In fact, his basis was what? What did the scribe say? Jerry? What did he say? This is in the end of verse 9. Right. Yeah, what if a spirit spoke to him? What if a spirit or an angel spoke to him? We have no idea that that's not happened. And so, who are we to say that what he's saying is not true? So, yes, that's right. And previously, Gamaliel had said, back in Acts chapter 5, you can't fight against God. Now, if this is of men, it'll go away to nothing. But if God's behind all this, you can't win that battle. So as far as this scribe is concerned, and I would think all the Pharisees would line up behind him, that was case closed. We need to dismiss Paul, and this is over. Was the high priest a Pharisee or a Sadducee? Do we have any way of knowing? Mm-hmm. I don't know. This statement by the scribe, this is an assumption I'm making. In verse 9, when it says, some of the scribes of the Pharisaic party, I would also assume that the Sadducees had their own scribes also. I would assume that. I don't know that for a fact. But you just can imagine, whoever is involved with this council, this makeup, they're going to pick the side, one or the other. It was just that divided. Now, where the high priest sat, which we know by this time, the high priest did not serve in the capacity as the old law taught. It was pretty much a political football that the Roman government would pass around from man to man almost annually. So maybe one year it was a Sadducee, maybe one year it was a Pharisee. I don't know. But at this particular moment, we're not told which side Ananias would line up on. But Paul has split the council with his statement. And the scribe that does speak up, his vote is, so to speak, that this is over. So, this uproar is happening, and the commander who brought him here, just a second, Rob, the commander who brought him here in hopes to find an answer, what does he see again? Not only no answer, but what seems to follow Paul everywhere he goes? Unrest, civil unrest, commotion, riots, uproars. And you have another one again now with the council itself. All right, Rob, why did Paul do this? Yes. Well, go ahead. I think Paul did it for the reason I think he did it on purpose. This was not accidental. And Paul he's already held. There's already been some sort of a kangaroo justice in the city with the mob seen earlier with the Jews, and that got nowhere. Paul knows he's a Roman citizen and he's entitled to the rights of a Roman citizen, which would mean a fair trial. If the commander drags him in front of this council, is he going to get a fair hearing? This is in front of the Jews. It's not going to work here either, so I think this was intentional. Yes, he could. Well, that's true. This is a divided council, a divided group of men. And Paul knew he would not get any real justice here. But really, Paul's not wanting justice from the Romans or from the Jews. He's wanting it from the Romans anyway. So this was not accidental. This was entirely intentional. Okay, so the commander must come in again and rescue Paul once more. He did it in chapter 21. We talked about that. He did it in chapter 22. Talked about it again. Now, the third time, the commander says, well, let's take him to the council. And it happens there again. And I've asked the question, top of page, this is top of page 130. Thought question in number 5. If you were this Roman commander, and you saw this happen for the third time, what might you thought about Paul? Everywhere I take this guy, he's trouble everywhere I take him. I can't get an answer on this guy's situation no matter where I take him. Maybe he's getting tired of fooling with Paul. I don't know what his thoughts were, but you can just imagine those kind of thoughts may have been running through his mind. But he's got to come in again, rescue Paul. So he gets Paul and he orders him to be taken where? Back to the castle or back to the barracks where they had him before. Just get him out of here. This one has to calm down before we get any further with this. This is not working either. Okay. So, Paul's visit before the council is over. One verse by itself, verse 11. What does Luke record for us? After this unrest this disturbance took place. What happens to Paul? All right, the Lord sends him a vision again. And what did the Lord say? All right, take courage, be of good cheer. What else, Paul? As you have testified about me in Jerusalem, you will do it also at Rome. So that told Paul what? He's going to go to Rome. And all this mess here in Jerusalem, Caesarea, I don't yet know how it's going to turn out, but I know I'm going to be at Rome. So that would have given Paul some comfort, I would surmise, in one way or another. No, sir. Now, how he's going to go, you are correct. He will not go as he thought he would go. He doesn't know he's going to be a prisoner. But anyway, and I've listed the passages there from the Roman letter that we studied recently when we surveyed that epistle. How that Paul actually wrote to Roman Christians, how he had hoped to plan to come to them. That had always been his plans. But it's not going to work out like he thought. But the Lord did say, you will go. Yes, I'm ready to die at Jerusalem. But now this vision tells him, well, it's not going to end for you here. You will be my witness at Rome and will testify for me. All right. Now, starting in verse 12, and we take this through verse 20. Here's 22. Another conspiracy against Paul. We've had a few of these already. What was the conspiracy? What was the plot? To kill him. Well, give me some specifics. How many were there? It said more than 40. More than 40 Jews came together. And what was their oath? We're not going to eat, we're not going to drink until what? Until Paul is dead. I wonder how hungry they got. Because they didn't get Paul. They did not succeed in that. Now what was their plan? Who did they come to with this plan of theirs? All right, they come to the chief priest and the elders, verse 14. And said, now look, as a band of men, we've bound ourselves together under this oath. But we need your help with one part of this little plan. What help did they need? Yeah, see, they don't have Paul. He's in Roman custody. So they said, listen, you call him, and though it's not stated, it's obviously implied, the Romans who are guarding him will have to comply with this and have him brought back to the council. You want to question him some more, all right? And so whatever route it would take to get him from the barracks to the council chambers, we're going to lie in wait. We're going to be in ambush. And we can promise you he won't make it there. We'll get him. Well, that sounds like a pretty good plan, doesn't it? But what was the part they weren't counting on? Somebody, who's the somebody that heard it? Paul's nephew. Only time we know that Paul had family. His sister's son. He overheard this. Someone says, what luck that was for Paul. What a stroke of luck. How would you answer that? That's not luck. That's not luck. That's right. We've been through these points today. We're going to ambush him. So, I believe this is providence at work. Absolutely providence. Just by way of comparison, Romans 8:28, God causes all things to work together for good to those that love Him and who are called according to His purpose. And as an Old Testament similar thought, in the story of Esther, remember chapter 4 and verse 14, when Mordecai has already said to Esther, you need to make yourself known to Ahasuerus, the king, to stop this plot of Haman. Another plot there to kill somebody. Some similarities here. And she first said, I can't do that. This king's not summoned for me. He'll chop my head off. Mordecai's statement. So do not think that you in the king's palace will escape this any more than the rest of us will. If you're a Jew, when that day comes, you're dead just like we are. And he also said, if you remain silent, he said, God will do what? God would raise up deliverance from another place. Mordecai didn't know who, just that it would happen. Here's providence at work. Unbeknownst to Paul, unbeknownst to the plotters, the 40 men, unbeknownst to the Romans, but known to God, here was this nephew, and he was in a prime position. He overheard this just by providence. And that was an element that would work, of course, in Paul's favor. God can use any of His people in so many ways, whether it's something big or something small. The nephew hears the plan, and so what does he do? All right, I've got to tell Paul this. So he comes and tells Paul. Then what does Paul do with the nephew? All right, he catches a centurion, doesn't he? Paul takes to a centurion and says, "Take this young man to the commander. He's got something that the commander has to hear something this young man's got to say." So they go to the commander, and the nephew tells the commander of this plot. He informs him the whole thing, doesn't he? What's the commander say? Yes, now you be quiet about this. I appreciate you telling me this. Now, you don't tell anybody else what you told me. Let's keep this hush. So that is how the conspiracy became known. Now, Paul knows. Now the Romans know. And these Jews who had plotted and schemed this, they were not going to, of course, be successful. Still hungry. Still hungry, still thirsty. That's right, Freddie. You're right. Okay. Well, we come to verse 23. And the commander now acts. Does he act swiftly, promptly? It appears that he does. What's the orders that he gives? Moving Paul to Caesarea from this point to the end of the chapter. All right. He calls two centurions. They would be in charge of how many men? 200. 100 for each one. He says, you get me what? What does he ask for? He says, I want 200 soldiers, 70 horsemen, and 200 more spearmen. Or some versions say archers or spearmen, but other armed soldiers. All right. 470 men for this one prison. The commander's taking no chances. Why would he be so concerned about protecting Paul? He was a Roman citizen. And he's already made the rounds to all these authorities. The news is getting around. What if Paul didn't make it to Rome and the emperor found out about that maybe this commander would fall through his hands? So he's taking no chances. He's in charge of how many men, this commander? 1,000. So he's got the means at his disposal to use. So he says, you get these men ready, and also something else for Paul. So supply Paul with what? A ride. Get him a mount for Paul. And we're going to take him, we're going to escort him to Caesarea. At the third hour of the night, which is about 9 p.m. So this is not going to be long in taking shape and being executed. All right. So in the cover of darkness, they're going to remove Paul from Jerusalem and this Jewish threat. What happens if they happen to meet this ambush along the way? They can handle it. 470 men against 40, they wouldn't be any problem. So the commander's got it all under control. Absolutely. All right. Well, he also decides to send a letter. He's sending this prisoner to Felix, but it would be improper to not include a letter. The governor would have no idea why he's getting this prisoner dumped in his lap, so to speak. So he writes the letter. And I asked you briefly, this is question 8, last part of question 8, summarize or outline the letter briefly. So you see the letter there in verse 26 through 30 is the letter. Here's the brief outline of it. It's addressed to Felix, the governor at Caesarea. And then what does the commander say in verses 27 and 28, basically? All right. He says, Paul had been treated by the Jews, apprehended by the Jews in Jerusalem. And so he says, and look what he says carefully now. He says, this man was arrested by the Jews and was about to be slain by them. I came upon them with the troops and rescued him, having learned that he was a Roman. Does anything about that bother you? That's right. The sequence is not quite correct, is it? Is this commander making himself look as good as he... Well, obviously he is. He's a politician. Why should I look like a fool? I've been able to not handle this whole situation the whole time, so I'm going to write this letter and make myself look pretty good. What did he learn that Paul was a Roman? Yes. About when he was going to do what? Beat him himself. He didn't learn Paul was a Roman from the crowd and go rescue him from the bloodthirsty Jews, as he's indicating in this letter. So this is a slight twisting of the facts. This is not exactly how it worked out. Although there is some elements of truth in this letter, his timing is not correct. But anyway, that's what he writes. Felix wouldn't know otherwise anyway, because he's not even in Jerusalem. And so then he says in the letter, Paul has committed no crime. There's nothing that he's done that's worthy of how he's being treated. And so I'm sending him to you, basically. And he also mentions the plot. And I took it upon myself to arm this escort and protect him. And basically, he's all yours. But that's why you're getting this prisoner. That's why you're getting Paul. So now, Paul comes to Caesarea. He comes to Antipatris that night. He arrives in Caesarea the next day with only the 200 horsemen. So the 70... the 70 what now? Let's see here. I'm getting my numbers mixed up here. 70 horsemen... Did I put that wrong on the chart? But the next day, leaving the horsemen to go on with him, they return. That should say 70, not 200. That's correct. That should be only the 70 horsemen who are with him. Everyone else went back to the barracks when they get to Caesarea. So when they came to Caesarea, the first thing they do is they deliver what to the governor? Two things. The letter and Paul. Felix gets the letter. And he gets Paul. Felix questions Paul. What's he asking? Where are you from? What province are you from? What's Paul's answer? I'm from Cilicia. He had earlier said, I'm from a province of no small means. Cilicia was an important province. When Felix hears the answer, Cilicia, does that pretty much grant Paul an audience before the governor? It does. Felix says, well, okay, I'll hear your case, but one condition. You're going to have your accusers come down here and present their case also. And that was the only fair thing to do. So he grants an audience to Paul. The accusers would come from Jerusalem, and then Felix would hear the case. And that takes us to the end of chapter 23. So now Paul has moved from Jerusalem. He's now in Caesarea. He's before Felix. And as we see, the Lord willing, on Sunday, chapter 24, that's the first new lesson that I handed out Sunday. Again, if you did not get lessons 54 through 56, you'll need that for Sunday. Send me after class, and I'll make sure you get a copy. So we'll pick up there in chapter 24 on Sunday. Thank you for your comments, Don, your participation.